Hi everybody, I'm Matt Stannard, Operations Director at Solidarity House Cooperative, and I'm really excited to tell you about our new podcast series, Human Rights in a Burning World, produced in partnership with the Common Good Foundation. When I started law school about 10 years ago, the world looked very different than it does today. In particular, although there were rough edges around some things and there were things beginning to strain at the seams, the future of international law and human rights and human freedom seemed like, to me, like it was on a slow and steady trajectory forward. The world looks very different now, not slow and steady. The bad things and bad people look different, and so do the good things and good people. This is first and foremost a series about good people. And in this introductory audio, I want to tell you more about it. To help me, I got Noah Novogradsky of University of Wyoming's International Human Rights Law Program. Please visit the Common Good Foundation's website, actwithus.org, when you're done listening to me talk your ear off about our series. It was March 2012. I was in my second year of law school, and three of us, a professor and two L's, traveled to Kenya for a week to assist in a land eviction case. A community of Samburu people were suing some very powerful entities in Kenya after getting violently run off the land they'd been occupying since the beginning of time. Besides being a really values-aligned trip for me and having the opportunity to travel with some incredible colleagues, the Samburu, with the help of domestic attorneys and international advocacy groups, were making a really compelling and fascinating legal argument. It was an adverse possession claim about the land that they'd been evicted from. An adverse possession claim, if you didn't know, it's basically a squatter's rights claim. Someone who doesn't have the legal title to the property acquires it through continuous occupation. But what was interesting about this claim is that to have indigenous people making that argument is a radical recapturing of that argument. And so I was very excited to help and obviously felt like it was a good cause. And we did help. My colleagues and I helped find documents, accounts by old colonials and maps to make that case that the Samburu clients had occupied that land since well before British and other powers came. You can read about the case and the legal theories around it in an article I wrote with my fellow clinician on that trip, Sabrina. It's in Cultural Survival Quarterly. It's called We Belong to the Land. The case was dismissed by the Kenyan courts in 2017 after years of litigation. Justice is elusive. The good guys lose a lot and keep at it. I'm the director of a media production cooperative called Solidarity House. And I love international human rights advocacy. I love it so much that even though I'm not working in the legal field now, I keep going back to international human rights. Now, thanks to a partnership with my friend Regina Paulos and her organization, the Common Good Foundation, you and I can go on those trips together.
I see a human-centered organizing and energy that has been nurtured in the international sphere coming home and looking at domestic problems through a human rights lens.
In this podcast series, we'll go to a lot of places and explore a lot of ideas about international law, human rights, and this violent and tumultuous world that we live in. We've had the opportunity to work with some amazing people in this field, and we've gathered them together for an ongoing conversation about the practice of human rights advocacy in an ever-challenging world, a burning world, in some cases, literally.
I'm Noah Novogradsky. I teach at the University of Wyoming College of Law, and I work on issues of the global HIV/AIDS pandemic, the rise of ISIS and other non-state actors, and I'm interested in promoting human rights internationally and globally, sometimes in the face of reactionary domestic politics.
Wyoming College of Law has a great international legal clinic, and
yeah,
we've done some good work.
These days, We are working on a problem of seafood slavery, an issue of corporate social responsibility. How do we produce meaningful remedies for victims of exploitation in the seafood industry? And we also continue to work on a landmark women's rights health case in Uganda. One example of the return to the domestic sphere has to do with the environment. Clearly, there are a lot of people focused on climate change refugees, broad international problems, who are sounding the alarm domestically and thinking that their attention is better spent locally.
Do they draw from international legal bodies, though, or doctrine?
I would say they have more experience at a variety of international institutions and with an international methodology of working with philanthropies, of NGOs, of domestic and international organizations around a certain problem. They are bringing that framework back home more than they are specific legal arguments. I think that's also happening in particular places, particularly with respect to indigenous rights or arguments about torture or jus cogens violations. But I see a human-centered organizing and energy that has been nurtured in the international sphere coming home and looking at domestic problems through a human rights lens. Well, I think there are more opportunities than ever before. There's been an absolute explosion in both international institutions, bodies that didn't exist 15 years ago, new anti-trafficking initiatives or environmental organizations. And obviously, there's great growth in the NGO world. And so students wanting to get involved to become practitioners on the international playing field, if you will, have more opportunities than ever before. And they tend to be focused either geographically, like they had an internship experience in a particular country, or they have family in a particular country, or they're focused on a specific foreign issue, like the Israel-Palestine conflict, or like human rights in China, or Kurdish rights issues, for example. The other organizing principle is thematically. This generation of students have been raised to think that the local is the global and vice versa. And it is not strange for many of our students to have lived abroad or engaged meaningfully on issues they care about prior to getting to law school. Of course, law is still a fairly hidebound profession, and bar associations are the epitome of localism, and licensing means that you do have to play the game. I see students who are chomping at the bit and have more opportunities than ever before to take their skill set and bring it to the world stage.
Is the number of clinical legal experiences for law students on the international and human rights level increasing or decreasing?
It's absolutely increasing. In the last 20 years, we've gone from a handful of human rights clinics to more than 40 in North America. It's a growth industry for sure. Sustaining the ability of these clinics to work with partners internationally, and just as importantly, to bring the international home, takes some cultivation. My sense is that law schools, in partnership with international organizations and institutions, are figuring it out and providing more opportunities than ever before.
Okay, so talking a little bit about the world scene, and particularly past 2016, I know I was taken by surprise with the Brexit vote. I underestimated kind of the resurgence of nationalism, and of course, some of this is tension with immigration and refugees and those politics and all of these things. And now it seems like the world is on fire, kind of both literally and figuratively, because of climate change, which is also driving unprecedented refugee crises and everything. So what, you know, what about that world? It feels like, you know, if you're a practitioner, you're kind of a firefighter in some ways, or at least you're wandering through the fire.
Clearly, there is a resurgence of nationalism, and in the Anglo-American world, this the expression of that nationalism has been a renewed form of populism and a retreat from some big international organizations. I think there are a lot of problems that capture the global imagination and that exceed the interest or capacity of any one state to address. And so in the background, there is a fully functioning collaborative international world driven by law, norms, and in many cases, lawyers. So the effort to combat HIV and AIDS, anti-drug trafficking or cybercrime, anti-terrorist initiatives are all truly global institutional practices, sometimes led by the UN, sometimes led by regional organizations, sometimes led by public-private partnerships like the Red Campaign or UNAIDS. There is a current political reality, a kind of hypernationalism that is in its ascendancy, and at the same time, there is an institutional resilience on the world stage. When it comes to climate change, when it comes to infectious diseases, when it comes to combating extremism and terrorism of different kinds, the state is no longer the only organizing principle, and in many places, it's increasingly irrelevant. The trend we saw up till 2016, which was strengthened first world driven international organizations, has clearly paused. And I think what we're seeing is that it's not only the Hungaries and Polands and Bolivias of the world that are retreating into a nationalist sphere, but more influential countries like Britain, Turkey, and the United States.
Brazil,
right.
Any thoughts about Brazil? As I've seen kind of the developments there, I've wondered if you had been keeping up with them because of some of the research you've done on AIDS and things like that.
I think it's a huge challenge, and I spent time in Chile recently, and Chileans who have embraced a stronger market-dominant, right-leaning economy are alarmed at the presence of a very important, arguably the most important country in South America taking this turn. Bolsonaro's approach to things like LGBT rights or indigenous rights is a scapegoating. There's a kind of meanness and directness that is not ignoring previously marginalized groups, but attacking them frontally. And I feel like that is raising alarms in even fairly conservative societies.
What does the international legal community do when countries turn that way, or when those developments happen? How do they regroup? How do they diagnose? Are they waiting for an opportunity to, you know, to maybe strike back or push back or something? Or you know, what does that sort of do to the dynamic of international practitioners when nationalism increases like that?
Well, I think international lawyers play offense and defense. So quite specifically, we as a community often deal with the immediate effects. Refugees, and I have to say Venezuela is a bigger problem in terms of refugee production and the implosion of a state spilling over across its borders than Brazil, for example. We don't have the specter of state collapse. But plainly, the international legal community can play offense when it comes to building institutions, bringing test cases, standing with the marginalized communities in countries. Sometimes showing solidarity and an alliance with an increasingly authoritarian with the victims of an increasingly authoritarian world can make all the difference. And reminding the LGBT community, the indigenous community, the poorest workers, that they are not alone and that there are people on the outside who are both materially and ideologically with them. And I think some of these quieter international practices can take on a heightened role. So, for example, police training initiatives and having first world standards and procedures and practices and even like the institutional design of detention centers can make a big difference in an increasingly authoritarian culture. So visits from international bodies take on heightened importance. Working groups from regional bodies are significant. I'm not a big fan of immediately isolate and ostracize, particularly in what Bob Bernstein calls an interdigitated world. I think keeping the internet going means a lot to activists in a variety of cultures, and engaging rather than isolating is clearly the modality for a lot of important humanitarian concerns. Yeah, these are disturbing times for lots of advocates of traditional international issues in countries experiencing this populist or nationalist turn. And in some places, lawyers play a bigger role than others. In Pakistan, the lawyers are on the front lines of a battle for the rule of law, for civil society. They march, they protest, they are jailed. Who would have ever thought that lawyers were the vanguard of social change, right? In other countries, it's important to pick your moments and reframe issues away from the nationalist prerogative. Let me give you one example. The LGBT community in Singapore has been pushing for recognition and an escape from colonial-era anti-sodomy laws for a long time. The way to do that is probably not to sue the government on a theory that has been adopted in other countries, but is still growing in acceptance domestically. The way to do that might be to have Fortune 500 companies say that that Singapore is going to have trouble attracting global talent and investment if it is a hostile place for a diverse workforce. Mm-hmm. Both are, in a sense, normative arguments, but it takes, it's a different tactical expression.
Professor Novogradsky describes a hopeful and challenging field where there are many opportunities and many fires to put out. We're going to describe those fires, those crises, people's attempts to explain them, to create the conditions of accountability and struggle against complacency and hostility. We'll learn about oppressed minorities and refugee crises, and whatever growing communities of migrants, from internally displaced to those fleeing civil war, to climate refugees and stateless people themselves, what their struggles are. We'll talk to an important scholar of third world human rights advocacy about the rise of authoritarianism in the world and a new assertion of impunity made by leaders. We'll discuss the difficult issue of socioeconomic rights, how to get nations to agree to feasibly implement them, and how it's difficult to actualize other rights without them. We'll talk about the people literally taking the law into their own hands through people's tribunals. We'll see how global predators want to commodify life itself through the unethical use of organ transplants or the exploitation of indigenous culture and genetic material or sex trafficking. And we'll talk about a whole lot more. We'll ask what it takes to create a jurisprudence of universal dignity. And we'll talk with those working to do it right now. We're doing this series in partnership with the Common Good Foundation. We're producing this series in partnership with the Common Good Foundation, a US-based nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness, providing education, creating and collaborating on projects that address international criminal law, transnational crimes, and international human rights violations. You can visit the Common Good Foundation and learn more about it at actwithus.org. You can get more information about the series there and about the foundation's work. And listen here, right on the platform that you're listening on now, for our first full episode, which is coming faster than you can say, Universal Declaration of Human Rights.